But first, to kick off the hour this afternoon, we're happy to be joined by a very talented and interesting guy, and a former pro athlete, personal development coach, entrepreneur, and author, along with Seth Davis, of a really wonderful and powerful new book called Empower, Conquering the Disease of Fear. We are pleased to be joined by Tariq Azim. Tariq, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have got quite a remarkable story, and this book is it's so terrific, and it's it's something that you do in your everyday life. And you've talked about your facility out in the Bay Area, San Francisco, and how you use physical activity as a means of finding internal peace. Can you explain that?
Yeah, look, I think there's so much around physical activity that's been neglected, and how much physical activity can be utilized to help medicate key mental and emotional deficiencies. If we're just conscious of the correlations the depth of physical activity has to the pain of mental and emotional health. So I've had a really interesting life story and journey that helped me acknowledge this very young. And when I saw what it did and how it affected and impacted my capabilities, my decision-making, my ability to embrace discomfort, I really felt it was something that the rest of the world should know. And it's kind of why I pursued my development initiative in that manner, and utilizing sport and physical activity to come in and solve for emotional imbalance.
Let's talk a little bit about your personal story. You came here with your family as refugees from Afghanistan, I believe in 1979, and built a life here. And I thought it was interesting that you talk about how it was difficult to have goals and dreams. Can you explain that?
There was no consistency for our family of being able to call anything home. So we very nomadic lifestyle, obviously, when we first got to the U.S., because the intentions were to always return to Afghanistan. My family actually left Afghanistan in 79 with the Soviet invasion and went to Germany with their refugee program, where I was born, in Munich. And we came to the U.S. in 85. And yes, a majority of my life, it was very difficult to have many goals and dreams, because one, we just didn't know if we, you know, were a part of the system here and we're going to be a part of the system. Second, you know, I obviously come from a family who had very, very deep roots and permanent infrastructure set in place for futures, to where we came to the U.S. and my parents couldn't even speak the language or understand what the culture consisted of and what life here consisted of. So it wasn't, I didn't have the privilege of being able to think about dreams and goals because our family was in a state of survival. It was really trying to figure out how we're going to eat the next meal. Is this government support going to carry us for as long as we need to stay? When are we going home? Is this home? So the uncertainty was a bit of a battle for several years until the decision was made that this was home.
And yet, even with that, you've said that your parents still had very high expectations for you.
They sure did, you know, because they were always big on human capability and human capacity. And how that formed was our DNA. You know, both my grandfathers, both paternally and maternally, were individuals who pursued life in a very not normal manner. They wanted to be the first of their kind to do the things that they did. And I was always extremely fascinated by that. And hence why I've never had the privilege of meeting my grandfathers. One passed due to natural causes, who was my paternal grandfather. And my maternal grandfather was another individual I never got to meet, but they've both been my heroes. And he was executed and taken in as prisoner by the communists, being one of the most, you know, decorated generals in the history of Afghanistan, who created Bagram Air Force Base.
What's the biggest misperception people in this country have of Afghanistan?
Well, there's quite a bit, right? And I think it's just the expectations more than it is the perception. You know, Afghanistan is a country that was way ahead of the game for a period of time. And then the country actually froze in 1979, from education to government to religion to, you know, commerce. It froze. And the rest of the country evolved tremendously at a very, very fast pace. And as you know, every decade, we're growing almost 10x what we should be growing due to capabilities of technology. So Afghanistan is kind of froze in 79, but then went backwards another 100 years. So I think the perception that most folks have of Afghanistan is primarily based on an expectation they expect a civil society to have. And Afghanistan isn't civil. It went backwards, and it bred three or four generations of savages, because the normal was killing. The normal was stealing. The normal was, you know, trying to survive and do whatever you can to survive. So the expectations are what kind of lead to the perception. It's not necessarily what Afghanistan's putting out. It's more what Afghanistan is and the world is expecting of it.
We're talking with Tariq Azeem here on Downtown. His book is called Empower. You made the decision to go back to Afghanistan in 2004. Did you recognize the country when you returned?
Well, I actually was born in Germany. My family left Afghanistan into a refugee initiative in Germany, like a holding place before we figured out what home was going to be. That's where I was born. But going to Afghanistan for my first time was in 2004. And I never really, I never expected to see Afghanistan how I saw it, given seeing all my family's properties and land and homes and wedding pictures and, you know, my grandfather in the media and in history books and seeing this, you know, beautiful, beautiful country. The landscape was still magnificent, but I'm talking about the civilization in Kabul alone, with attire and character and you know, systems completely opposite of what I you know, obviously was always told about in hearing old family stories. When I got to Afghanistan, it was literally like an episode of the Game of Thrones.
You made the decision to use sport, to use physical activity, to put people on a different path in a different direction, and especially what makes it more remarkable to me, especially women.
Yeah. Look, I got to Afghanistan and I had an intention of being there for about a month and a half, right? I thought I would go in there to solve this family issue I was there for quick, thinking there were systems put in place like there is here. And unfortunately, it's a completely different beast. And I ended up staying in Afghanistan for about 4.5 years. And when I got to Afghanistan, again, I went there for a family issue. And I just said, like, look, there's so much more I can add to this country outside of coming here and fighting. And I saw that the issue here was that there was no methods to help reconcile peace in this country. And I thought that sport was an answer for that. And I thought sport and physical activity could also be a fantastic PR play for the new Afghanistan. And a lot of how Afghanistan was feeling about Afghanistan wasn't what was being portrayed in the media. What was being portrayed in the media was the complete opposite of what their desires were. And I said, how do I compete against the most, you know, how do I compete against the largest media outlets in the world without being political or without being too much of a anti, you know, media movement? And I knew that sport was something that was completely underutilized and not respected or valued on the impact and the efficacy of it. And I decided, like, what can I do to prove to the world that Afghanistan was ready for change, and primarily social change? And I decided, like, I wanted to launch the Afghan Women's Boxing Federation. And why I launched that boxing federation for women wasn't to create any fighters or any boxers. It was to prove to the world that change was accepted and embraced and needed. But these women also utilize this boxing program to leverage including themselves for inclusion into male-dominated roles in society. If they are doing the most male-dominated activity known to mankind, one of the most male-dominated societies of all time, why shouldn't they be okay joining the Ministry of Defense or the Ministry of Interior or the Ministry of Education or the Ministry of Health or Parliament? And that's what the intention behind the program was. And that's why it took off the way it did.
Let's talk about some of the work you do with athletes and others. Can you talk a bit about the importance of what you call a mindset shift?
Yeah, look, a majority of my work throughout professional sports, whether it's been in the National Football League or the UFC or some of the cycling world with Tour de France or Major League Baseball, I built my initial round of wanting to prove my concept with the shift in mentality based around a product I designed called game plans. And game plans are just a branded term for something called an honest conversation. And I actually realized that honest conversations were something that just didn't really exist in the development of people, not just athletes. It started with just athletes and they carried over into, you know, both Wall Street, Silicon Valley and several other sectors, military included. But the shift in mind actually came from the consciousness of deficiencies, getting people into a state of really realizing what is it that's preventing them from this peace they're seeking. And pretty consistently, I had the privilege of doing about 5,600 case studies in the last 16 years. I'll call them case studies, but just like internal clinical trials inside my facilities. And obviously the engagements I do when I would travel, the most common deficiency everybody would fear when it came to the field, when it would come to their piece was fear. It was always the fear of something. And I'd always really push this fear on how folks actually define fear, and folks define fear differently, right? Mm-hmm. Folks define fear on judgment, on uncertainty, on X, Y, and Z. And I would just push and push and push and push. And I'd realize that the fear that most and everybody would suffer from was the unknown. And my question is, what is the ultimate unknown? And what do you think everybody says, Rich, when I say, what's the ultimate unknown?
Death.
Thank you. And when they say death, then I know I have an opportunity to be a teammate here, because I help them acknowledge the truth, which is that death isn't an unknown. It's actually the only guarantee. And why isn't this what we're preparing for if it's the only guarantee? Why are we preparing for everything else and not the truth? Which then helps me realize there's a lot of correlations with other truths that are missing or not getting permission in life. And that was what really helps lower the waterline and open up the shift in mentality on where else truths don't exist if I'm not accepting the ultimate truth, which is death. And I realized that a majority of this was the fear was always stimulated tremendously because of this other common component denominator we had, is that the whole world is actually seeking the exact same thing. And when I speak of the whole world, I'm talking about my community, is acceptance. So and I realize, like, if we're suffering from fear and all we're seeking is acceptance, and the reality is we're actually fearing acceptance. And that shift, that's the basis of our shift. And that's the basis of this mindset. And the mindset really starts to develop this responsibility into honoring how to feel better about that, of what you define when it comes to fear and what you define when it comes to acceptance.
And part of moving forward, making progress, as you point out, is also accepting that there are some things that are just out of our control.
Correct. And again, that's a truth, right? It's another truth. Like, when you finally get to practice the behavior and develop the endurance of accepting truth, you just become pretty accepting almost everything and anything, because you just have to. And we're actually designed to be able to acclimate to every circumstance if we give ourselves permission to. But then we get trapped in that word called hard, right? Like, it's hard to do that. And because hard has been embedded in our head as something to avoid, very similar to the word fear, part of my shift in perspective is around getting the relationship with words reorganized, and actually understanding that these things mean opportunity. These things actually mean chance. These things actually mean your evolvement. And knock on wood, it's been a huge success for my stable and my teammates. We've all kind of pushed ourselves to reach things and feel things we've never felt before, because there's been this philosophical alignment around the values that come from this thought process.
A lot of great stories in the book. I love the story, especially of Justin Tuck, the former NFL player who, as he was adjusting to life after the game, talked about the need for discomfort.
Yeah. And we would go through a lot of this practice because at that point, there was nothing physical that he had gone through that wasn't uncomfortable, right? He's gone through it all, from blown out pec, blown out shoulders, knees, fingers, face, back, neck, and he's been able to deal with it. He's been able to embrace it. He's been able to grow from it. He's been able to solve from it. He's been able to rehab through it. And it's always been a state of discomfort. And we stayed very mindful on being able to carry that exact same capability into feelings around new sectors. And we kind of made a challenge to one another that we won't pursue anything in life that makes us that makes us comfortable. Let's pursue everything and anything that makes us uncomfortable, and just know we've got a teammate or two that are doing the exact same thing. And I actually reflect on Tuck a lot, especially his post-career life. The fact that he didn't have to do what he did by pursuing higher education, with having two beautiful sons and a wife, and traveling to Warden every single day from Jersey on a two-hour journey, go to school full-time, advise and do an internship at the same time, and play full-time father and husband. Every time I would feel sorry for myself about anything I had going on, I just think of Tuck. And I'd look to myself and I'd look to my notes and I'd look to kind of, you know, our strategy. I said, look, like this man is actually not being a hypocrite. I am. I'm trying to avoid this discomfort, find the comfort in it. So he actually became a fantastic reflection point for me.
So in conquering the disease of fear, as you call it, how important is it to have a support system in place?
It's 100% important to have a support system in place. And what a support system really means to my stable is that if you don't build a relationship with fear and understand why it exists, you're going to have a problem. And I think the most important part about it is acknowledging that fear is a disease if you don't embrace it. And when you embrace it, it allows you to start to develop values, a philosophy, a perspective. And when you have a baseline, if you have a baseline value system and a baseline perspective and a baseline philosophy, you'll have enough to hold to a system of supporters that could be philosophically aligned or value aligned with you. And when you have that, then you know you're actually understood, right? You feel understood, you're understanding yourself, therefore you know how to help have people understand you. And that's how you develop a support system. I'm not a fan of having a support system that is just there to just say yes to you and push you and we're there for you. This very empty, airy support. I'm not a fan of. I think even support has a responsibility from both sides, and it's that. It's the acknowledgement of capabilities.
Well, you've got a remarkable story. You're using everything that you've learned in helping other people move forward in life as well. The book is wonderful. It's called Empower, Conquering the Disease of Fear. Tariq Azim, thank you so much for being with us today.
Rich, you're the best. I'm so happy to be here. It's an honor to meet you, and I look forward to hopefully connecting again.
All right. Be well. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, my man.
Tariq Azim with us on Downtown. The book written along with Seth Davis is called Empower.